No, so we're doing Major Prophets, which is scheduled for this time. So we're plunging into Ezekiel chapter 23, and it's a long chapter, which I'll skim over and summarize. It's a parable or a story. You could say allegory if you like, but it's more commonly called the parable of the two adulterous sisters. Isn't that a happy thought? No, I'm speaking sarcastically. This is very reminiscent of Ezekiel chapter 16. And I spend a little more time looking at the graphic portrayal there of a man, you know, taking care of basically an infant girl, raising her to maturity and then marrying her, but then having her cheat on him, commit adultery, to his great hurt and dismay. And in that case, the man is picturing God and the adulterous wife is Israel. Here we have almost the same thing, except it makes the distinction between the northern kingdom Israel and southern kingdom Judah. But other than that, it's about the same. I will mention sort of a comparison. If you look back to the other prophets, Isaiah is known for his beautiful language, wonderful poetry and all that. Ezekiel isn't known for his poetry, but he is known for very powerful images. Graphic language, symbolism that's very strong and vivid, and this fits within that, along with chapter 16. So we begin, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, there were two women, daughters of one mother, that makes them sisters. They committed harlotry in Egypt in their youth. So it portrays idolatry. Remember, idolatry is symbolized by adultery, or in this case, fornication, you know, sexual acts before marriage. And God is reminding Israel that they picked up a lot of their false worship all the way back when they were in Egypt. And actually, history shows that many of the aspects of Babylonian false religion did come from Egypt and was moved further into Europe. So some of the elements of Greek mythology and later the Roman gods derive from Babylon, which derived from Egypt to some sense. And overarching all of that was sun worship. Sun worship goes way, way back in human history, and it informs some of this. So we see God is referring to things that really happened, only he's portraying it as these sisters. Their names were Aholah, the elder, and Aholabah, the sister. Aholah, the Hebrew means her tent or her dwelling. Aholabah is a derivation that means my tent in her. So Aholah is Samaria, or Israel, the northern kingdom. Aholabah is Judah, or Jerusalem. Okay, in verse 4, he says, they were mine, meaning God married Israel. And I'm not sure, I haven't heard any discussion of great significance to this meaning, other than, you know, when God married Israel, he wanted to live with them, have a close relationship. And that's something we'll see in the Pentateuch. When God organized the camp of Israel, the tabernacle was set right in the middle. So anyways, let's carry on. In verse 4, when it says, they were mine, is referring to, you know, as God said, I am married to you. Reference Jeremiah 3 and verse 14, among other places where God's covenant with Israel is pictured as a marriage. So, but then there's, you know, the wife in this case, or two wives, which we never recommend, by the way, but this is using an allegory, not that God promotes polygamy, but we see it begins in verse 5, Aholah, so this is the elder, played the harlot, even though she was mine, even though she was married to me, she lusted for her lovers, the neighboring Assyrians. At the end of verse 7, it says, with all their idols, she defiled herself. Making the point that adultery is symbolic of two major things, primarily idol worship. And we discussed this earlier in the class. Also, it can refer to making alliances with other nations. And here we see Assyria. And as we went through Isaiah, I made the point that God wanted Israel and Judah to trust him, not make alliances with other nations and trust them for protection. So we see both of these elements that are symbolized by adultery come in. So we see it first with the northern kingdom, which fits our history. Remember, Jeroboam made the two golden calves, said, these are your gods, you know. So the northern kingdom led in idolatry. But we'll see later that the southern kingdom did worse, I think. I'm skipping ahead to verse 11. Now, although her sister Aholibah saw this, she became more corrupt in her lust and in her harlotry. She lusted for the neighboring Assyrians, it says in verse 12. Verse 14, she increased her harlotry, looked at men portrayed on the wall, images of Chaldeans portrayed in vermilion. Vermilion is a type of reddish color that is associated with Babylon. So God is saying, yeah, the older sister started it, and the younger sister said, yeah, I want that too, and went further, saw pictures of men and said, yeah, I want those, and sent for them from afar. So it's, matter of fact, it gets pretty graphic in a way. Verses 20 and 21 says she lusted for her paramours whose flesh is like the flesh of donkeys and whose issue is like the issue of horses. Basically comparing male genitalia to that of animals, equines, which seems to symbolize basically seeking sensual pleasure, physical satisfaction more than spiritual. And we could say going to an extreme, that say to put it mildly. So it's going to this extreme in wanting others rather than God. And that fits with what you've probably covered in former prophets, the syncretism, saying, let's get all these other gods, let me see how they worshiped and add it to ours. And Judah was worse. Israel kept going back to just the golden calves, which is bad, but Judah would say, give me this god and that god and the other one, and we'll bring them all together, which made God even more angry, in a sense, because he might say, couldn't you look at what happened to the northern kingdom and learn from them? You know, avoid that. Verse 22 says, behold, I will stir up your lovers against you, from whom you've alienated yourself. I'll bring them against you from every side. So it makes the point, perhaps in a sense of irony, that the very nations with which, you know, Israel committed adultery, God would use them to come and punish Israel. You wanted an alliance with Assyria? Assyria will come and conquer you. You wanted an alliance with Babylon to save you from Assyria, so the Babylonians will come in and conquer. And it goes from there. So there's a long series of verses describing the punishment, the other nations to come. And it mentions the Chaldeans. This is verse 23. Chaldea, Pekod, Shoah, and Koah. And scholars who study the history and the geography say they're not sure if those names represent specific ethnic groups or regions or some combination of both, but it's a variety of peoples. And verse 25, it mentions, they shall remove your nose and your ears. Interestingly, studying in the culture of Egypt and Babylonia, that's one of the punishments they would invoke against women who were guilty of adultery. Cutting off at least their earlobes or whole ears and the tip of the nose as a symbol of that. Some people think it might be because that's where jewelry was often worn. Now, I could point out, it's kind of a shame. It shows the imbalance in society that women would be punished for adultery in such an extreme way, but not men. But God doesn't make the distinction. You know, guilty of sin is guilty of sin, regardless of your gender. But God is calling, you know, pointing out what really happened in those societies and using that to talk about what Israel would suffer. So verses 26 through 30 continue to describe abasement and punishment. And we could say that that's happened. And as a result, partly, the Jewish people, for the most part, have became very serious about avoiding all types of idolatry. It's worth giving them credit. As I've said, after the Babylonian captivity, they became pretty serious about keeping the Sabbath and avoiding any trace of idolatry. The other tribes of Israel didn't and lost their identity. Let me move ahead in verse 31. So I hope you don't mind, I'm skimming across largely because this is a similar story to what we've read. Verse 31, you've walked in the way of your sister, therefore I'll put her cup in your hand, says the Lord. You shall drink of your sister's cup, the deep and wide one. So in other words, Judah, you're going to be punished like Israel. Conquest, being taken into captivity. Verse 35, I'll move ahead. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, because you've forgotten me and cast me behind your back, therefore you'll bear the penalty of your lewdness and your harlotry. There was some degree of sin, not only in seeking other gods, but in forgetting the true God. He said, you cast me behind your back. You weren't paying attention anymore. So he wouldn't be there to save them. So if you'll allow me, verses 36 through 44 repeat again describing the sin, you know, the worshiping false idols, breaking God's law. I'm not sure a false idol is false gods. An idol is really an idol, but it's not a god. So they were guilty of doing that. He describes all of their sins. And then from verses 45 through 49, there's a summary of God's punishment. One thing that's worth us considering, I don't want to dwell on at length, but remember, it seems that much of Ezekiel's prophecies have at least the possibility of being dual prophecies or end time. And if we look at our modern societies, we can see that our modern societies are largely guilty of tossing God behind our back and worshiping false ideas and making alliances. So we're caught up in sin, sins not worse than that of ancient Israel. Some would even say, yeah, they were guilty of child sacrifice, and we have abortions by the millions. You know, so what punishment might we be bringing on ourselves? And we've seen in these prophecies what seems to be prophecies of war, pestilence and famine, and going into captivity. So it's worth us keeping in the back of our minds that, you know, this happened to ancient Israel. Much of it could be something that lies ahead for our countries at the end time. And I like to couch it in tentative terms because it's not always clear what's end time prophecy and what's not. But sometimes we think of if there's a law, a cause and effect type prophecy, like those of Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, we should look for the effect for the cause that's among our people, and it's not a pretty one. Take a pause, and then we move ahead in chapter 24, which is a bit more brief, and here Ezekiel gives us a time notation. Again, in the ninth year, in the 10th month, on the 10th day of the month. So if there's 12 months in a year, this is near the end of the ninth year. So this seems to be referring to the time of his captivity, which parallels the time of Zedekiah's reign. And we believe that's what happened. And God tells him, okay, write this down. This day, the king of Babylon started his siege against Jerusalem. So God had Ezekiel announce to the people back in Babylon that the Babylonian armies are now around Jerusalem. Which is cool because they couldn't turn on CNN and find out, you know, there's no Fox News or Sky News or whatever else, but God let Ezekiel know and can pass it on to them. Okay, the siege has begun. It started in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, and it would last about 1.5 years. So it was an ongoing process. So it's happened, and then in verse 3, utter a parable to the rebellious house. And it goes into poetic form, and some scholars think this might have been a song that was popular at that time. Using this analogy of putting on a pot and put in pieces of meat and the choice cuts and then pile, it says fuel bones in the New King James, and that's referring to firewood. So get it all set up and build up the fire. We've seen imagery like this. Matter of fact, back in Ezekiel 11 and verse 3, it seems the people of Jerusalem used that imagery, thinking it was about their protection. We're the meat, and Jerusalem is the cauldron, like there's iron walls protecting us. God will take that same imagery and turn it around and say, yeah, you're the meat in a pot, and you're about to be cooked. You know, it's not going to go well for you. I'll mention one other thing. Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 13. Jeremiah 1:13 is where God shows Jeremiah one of his first visions, and he sees a pot boiling, and he says it's towards the north. So it's a similar imagery, this boiling pot, and Jeremiah's time represented the coming destruction from the north. And so we see that. So some people think in verse 4 where it says the choice cuts, the choice of the flock, might be in particularly referring to the leaders of the nation, the royalty, the princes, perhaps the priests, they're in there too. And verse 6, woe to the bloody city whose scum is in it. The scum is not gone from it. Bring it out piece by piece on which no lot has fallen. No lot, you know, casting lots is done to make a choice. This might be saying the destruction is going to be indiscriminate. There's no lot. It's fallen on everybody, and randomly different people will be taken by it. At least that seems to fit. And verses 7 through 14 continue to talking about the bloody city, kindle the fire, cook the meat, and then when it's boiled down, put the pot on and even burn up the pot. In this case, Jerusalem is the pot. The people are the ingredients within, and then it seems the fire represents the Babylonian army. So it's a pretty easy analogy, and it's saying the siege has begun, and you're like people stuck in a pot, and the fire is turned up, and you're going to get burned up. I want to reference back something I missed in verse 7, might be referring to improper use of sacrifices. It says, her blood is in her midst. So some would say that's referring to the violence. We saw this morning, talked about the bloody city, but also says she set it on top of a rock. She did not pour it on the ground. It is worth thinking that when a sacrifice was made, you were supposed to slit the throat and let the blood out. You'd catch some in a basin for sprinkling on the altar, but it was meant to be the rest go in the ground so it could be soaked in and not used for anything else. Certainly never for human consumption. So putting it on top of a rock rather than in the ground where it could soak in is leaving it exposed, something God didn't want done in the sacrificial system. It's not absolutely certain he's referring to that, but we're not sure why else he would mention it here. So we get to the end of verse 14, and without me reading all of it, you see this imagery. Okay, the siege has begun. The people in Jerusalem are like ingredients in a pot that's boiling, and we're going to pile on the fuel till it's all burned up and ruined. Now we turn back away from that allegory and talk to some things about Ezekiel and something very serious and personal. Verse 15, the word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, behold, I take away from you the desire of your eyes with one stroke. Yet you shall not mourn, nor weep, nor shall your tears run down. Sigh in silence. No mourning for the dead. So Ezekiel is about to lose somebody, the desire of his heart. We see who that is at the end in verse 18. I spoke to the people in the morning. Keep in mind, he's only allowed to speak to the people when God gives him a message. And at evening, my wife died. That's pretty sad. It doesn't tell us why she died. We could imply God killed her to make a point. And, you know, that's within God's prerogative. I'd prefer to think maybe she was sick and God chose not to heal her, to, you know, taking advantage of this opportunity to make a lesson. That's what I would prefer to think, but I have to present it that way because it just doesn't tell us what the circumstances are. But we do see, you know, Ezekiel is told, don't mourn. Normally, they would go through a mourning period. He'd rip a garment, perhaps pluck hair or shave and, you know, things like that. He says, no, you got to keep your turban on. Don't do any sign. And the people will notice. Verse 19, the people said, won't you tell us what these things signify? Ezekiel, what's going on? And it's not that it was a loveless marriage. She was the desire of his eyes. You know, we imply that means they had a happy marriage. They wanted to spend time together. So in verse 20, Ezekiel answers, this is the word of the Lord. Speak to the house of Israel. Thus says the Lord God, behold, I will profane my sanctuary, your arrogant boast, the desire of your eyes. So the sanctuary, the desire of their eyes, that's either Jerusalem as a whole or maybe the temple itself. You know, they were in captivity. They wanted to be able to go back. We know from Jeremiah, particularly Jeremiah chapter 7, that the people did hold the temple in high regard, even if they didn't worship God properly. It's worth remembering the temple in Jerusalem was considered to be one of the wonders of the ancient world. It was this magnificent building, and it's going to be destroyed. And so he's saying Ezekiel lost the desire of his eyes and he couldn't mourn. God is saying, you shall do as I have done. This is verse 22. You shall not cover your lips nor eat man's bread of sorrow. Verse 23, turbans on your head, sandals on your feet. You shall not mourn or weep. Thus Ezekiel is a sign to you. According to all that he's done, you shall do. Some would say this is another pantomime, a very serious one. Ezekiel, you've got to act out. And I think there's a twofold aspect of this. He's saying the people, you know, they're away in captivity and they're serving their masters. They're not going to be able to mourn and take a national day of mourning or whatever the way we would do in our society. So they're restricted from being able to mourn this. And in a sense, they've already suffered. It's already happened. I can't help but think, though, is there another aspect of this? Who else is losing something that he loved and was very special to him? And I see you nodding. God himself. If Judah was like his wife, okay, now the time of the punishment's come. It's well-deserved, but God himself has to be the one inflicting the punishment. He can't take the time to mourn and be sad. And so it's kind of like Ezekiel. This is duty. It has to be done. But man, does that stink. You know, God's not happy and rejoicing. He's like he's losing his wife, the same as Ezekiel did. And I think it's worth keeping that in mind. Mind you, I'll admit this is an interpretation I'm putting on this. I think it's proper, but it doesn't say it in so many words. So it's worth, you know, keeping in mind that I think that aspect is there. Okay, it goes on. There's going to be another change. And verse 26, on that day, one who escapes will come to let you hear it in your ears. On the day means when Jerusalem is conquered. And on that day, verse 27 says, your mouth will be open to him who has escaped. You'll speak and no longer be mute, and thus you'll be a sign to them. They'll know that I am the Lord. So basically, God lets Ezekiel know the siege has started. And when you hear that it's ended, I'm going to end the muteness. That muteness goes back, I had to double check, Ezekiel chapter 3, verses 26 and 27. So early on in the book, God told him, you're going to be mute. You can't speak unless I give you a message. And we speculated, does that mean he was silent all the time or it was public speaking? And we don't know for sure. But we know it's like the people out there, if Ezekiel's saying something, it means God gave him a message. He didn't just walk up and say, hey, how's the weather? What do you think of, did you see the Bears game last night? You know, Ezekiel's not allowed to have that with people. But that's going to end. And it will happen. Actually, you can turn a few pages ahead. In chapter 33, we see this fulfilled. 33 verse 21 says, it came to pass in the 12th year of our captivity in the 10th month on the 5th day of the month, one who escaped from Jerusalem came to me and said, the city's been captured. The end of verse 22, it says, and he opened my mouth. So when he came to me in the morning, my mouth was opened. I was no longer mute. So God let him know it was coming. It's about a year and a half later, it happens. So Ezekiel's been mute for some years, at least in a public sense, but not all of his life. So I think it's kind of cool to put it together to say it's predicted and then it happens. Yeah, I want to briefly, again, I'm being brief with all of these, but chapter 25. We begin actually, and I'll mention this, chapters 25 through 32 are all prophecies against some of Israel's neighboring countries. So Israel's neighbors. And the ones who are relatives are mostly relatives mentioned in chapter 25. Much more briefly than what we've covered in Isaiah and Jeremiah, but it is similar. And from there, we're going to go on and talk about Tyre and Egypt, so other nations also. But it says in chapter 25, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, set your face against the Ammonites. Say to them, I love it in verse 3, because you said, aha, against my sanctuary when it was profaned. So it's not just pronouncing the word, aha, God's not against that, but it was the attitude. Ammon rejoiced when Jerusalem was besieged and when it was conquered. And God says, you're going to get it too. You're going to be punished. Verse 5 says, I will make Rabbah a stable for camels. We saw Rabbah earlier when Nebuchadnezzar was trying to decide which road to take, which city to conquer first. So it was a great Ammonite city, and it would be conquered after Jerusalem. So we have that. We drop down to verse 8. We'll see something similar. Thus says the Lord God, because Moab and Seir say, look, the house of Judah is like all nations. Moab is another country that's, you know, they're descended from Lot's, one of Lot's sons. Seir is a part of Edom. So we're covering two of the nations there. But they're saying, look, Jerusalem's not special. Judah doesn't have a special relationship with God. They're just like all the other nations. Well, God is saying, well, I'm going to make the point that that's not the way it is. I'm going to punish you for saying that. Yeah, verse 9, I'll clear the territory of Moab of cities, the cities of its frontier. Verse 10, to the men of the east, I'll give it as a possession together with the Ammonites. Okay, let's drop down to verse 12. Thus says the Lord God, because of what Edom did against the house of Judah by taking vengeance, and has greatly offended by avenging itself on them, therefore I'll stretch my hand against Edom. We don't know. Edom was often looking for opportunities to take advantage of Judah and or Israel. There seems to be some indication that they may have joined to help the Babylonians, you know, to fight against Judah. And God would punish them for that. Now in verse 14, there's something that causes us to question. It says, I will lay my vengeance on Edom by the hand of my people Israel, that they may do in Edom according to my anger. That seems to be saying that God is going to use the people of Israel to punish Edom. We don't have record of that having been done, at least not in the Bible, and even since then. Now, you could question, you know, okay, when like the British Empire conquered parts of the Middle East, did that fulfill this? We could question. Some people would try to connect it to the United States imposing its power, like in Operation Desert Storm and Desert Shield. But there might be reason to think this is looking to something that has not yet happened. Maybe it hasn't been fulfilled of God using Israel to punish Edom. I'm saying maybe because it's questionable, but it's worth thinking about. Anyways, I'll move on. And starting in verse 15, thus says the Lord God, because the Philistines dealt vengefully and took vengeance with a spiteful heart because of the old hatred. Yeah, old hatred. Think how long the Israelites have been fighting the Philistines. So they've still been involved in this. And God's saying, okay, I'm going to punish them just as well. There's a mention, in verse 16, it mentions the Cherethites or Kerethites. That's a subpart of the Philistines, we believe. Interestingly, a number of people think that many of the current Palestinians are still descended from the Philistines, so maybe that old hatred and animosity is still going on. Maybe, but that might be going further than we need to. Any questions? I hope you don't mind. I sort of zipped over this, but I'm doing so partly because it's covering, again, material and concepts we have done. Yes, Austin?
I'm just going back to when Ezekiel's wife dies. Mm-hmm. This is completely speculative, but do you reckon Ezekiel's wife could have been unfaithful, just like, you know, Jerusalem has been unfaithful to God?
I wouldn't say it's impossible, but we don't have any information one way or the other. So I tend to think if that were the case, it'd be likely that God would put something in, but it would make the parallel more complete, which I'm guessing is what sparked that thought. But I don't know of any information anywhere to say one way or the other. Okay, thanks for your attention. I know today's one of those days.